Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass influence each other, and how did their relationships shape American history? While Douglass was born a slave and Lincoln rose to the nation's highest office, their formative years were surprisingly similar. From coming of age in poverty without their mothers and without access to formal education, to recognizing the power of words and developing an extraordinary command of the language, to taking on goals that many in their day might have imagined impossible. As my guest today will explain, these two men, who began as political adversaries, developed a seemingly impossible friendship that would shape how both men viewed the world and how their power was to change it. John Stauffer is chair of the History of American Civilization and professor of English at Harvard University. His new book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks. It's good to be on air.
We have this idea, especially with revered historical figures like Douglass and particularly Lincoln, that they were sort of born great. We have this mythology, even about their early brilliance, that doesn't even imagine that they had to sort of come to this sort of greatness. But telling the two stories together helps us to understand that it was reinventing themselves that really what made them so great.
That's right. That's exactly right. I think way too often, particularly in our culture today and over the last 20 years, too many people believe that great leaders or great people are simply born great. Essentially, they place way too much emphasis on what we think of now as genes, rather than acknowledging all of the contingencies of life and of history. And both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln acknowledged that they ultimately had no control over their fate. They both quoted the same line from Shakespeare's Hamlet, which was, there's a divinity that shapes our unruh poet, though it may be. They understood that they were very lucky. They were both lucky to survive their adolescence because they lived in such a brutal, vicious world. Douglass was lucky to be born in Maryland. Had he been born in Mississippi or Alabama, his chances of running away and becoming free would have been virtually nil. And both of them understood that, as in their own self-identity, that they were, in a sense, first and foremost self-made men. One of Douglass's most famous speeches that he gave well over 50 times was on self-made men, and he gave a template of what constituted a self-made man, and it constituted luck, hard work, faith in God, environment. So it was this this mix of ingredients that came together, and as I said, both he and Lincoln ultimately said that they had no control over their destiny, which ironically cuts against the very ideal of individualism, which is a central ideal in the American experience.
They both had a sense from an early age that knowledge and education could deliver them from their humble circumstances, but it seems like Douglass's epiphany is particularly striking. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, Douglass, as a slave, was not allowed to read or write. Most of the slave states legally prohibited masters from teaching slaves to read or write. In Maryland, there was not a law prohibiting it, but it was a widespread practice. And Douglass, I argue, was a privileged slave for a number of reasons. His father was a white man. He suspected that his father was one of his masters, Thomas Auld, and at one point as a boy, he sent to Baltimore to be a playmate with Hugh Auld's, Thomas Auld's brother, son. So he's in Baltimore, and Sophia Auld, his mistress, was the first time a slave owner. She and her husband, it was the first time that they had slaves under their control. And so Douglass was this curious, eager black boy who was a playmate with their son, and he wanted to learn how to read just like their son did, and so Sophia Auld taught him his ABCs. And when her husband found that out, in front of Douglass, criticized her and said something to the effect that teaching a slave to read and write is the quickest way to destroy their usefulness as a slave. And Douglass understood that. He remembered that and said, if my master feels that acquiring language is going to destroy my self as a slave or my identity as a slave. That's I'm going to acquire knowledge. And so from that point forward, he essentially learned how to read and write. He had learned his basic ABCs from Sophia Auld. From that point, he interacted with a lot of white boys on the streets of Baltimore, and he literally traded biscuits for words. And he'd find chalk and write words down on barrels and walls on the wharves of Baltimore. And that's how he acquired his basic literacy. And then he, on the sly, shined shoes for some white men and collected enough pennies such that one day he went into a bookstore, and he remembered it all his life, and bought a used copy of The Columbian Orator, which is a very popular elocution manual designed for young boys to become public speakers. At the time, public speaking was one of the most important arts in the United States. It was one of the only forms of entertainment. So if you could be a great orator, no matter where you came from, you could rise up far beyond your original station. And so, and these white boys were practicing from the Columbian Orator. Douglas goes in, he puts down his change, he gets the Columbian Orator, and he said that the Columbian Orator became for him as sacred as the Bible, and he essentially read and reread all of these classic speeches. And the Columbian Orator, the essential message in it was of freedom, was of universal freedom. And in fact, Southern states by the 1850s banned it from, it was part of their blacklisted books. And in fact, Douglas referred numerous times to one of the speeches or a dialogue between a master and slave. And the slave, in a debate with a master, convinces his master that he should be free. And so that was a crucial turning point. I mean, Douglas's discovery of the Columbian Orator, and more broadly his discovery of literacy and the power of words to act as weapons, became for him analogous to a conversion experience. That's how powerful it was.
And meanwhile, a decade before and hundreds of miles away, Abraham Lincoln was exploring the same book and the same ideas.
That's exactly right. Within a year of Douglas having an epiphany of because of Columbian Orator, Abraham Lincoln discovers the same book. Lincoln discovers the same book. Lincoln understands, just like Douglas does, that the Columbian Orator is a tool for him to rise up. Lincoln was born dirt poor. He was referred to by middle class and upper class whites and blacks as poor white trash. It was a common expression of the time. Lincoln's father thought that education was essentially useless. Lincoln grew up in an environment where manual labor was the only thing that essentially he knew, and he hated it. So he had a yearning for language and for the world of ideas in much the same way that Douglas did. And so the Columbian Orator for him was similarly a kind of epiphany, although Lincoln doesn't describe. Lincoln doesn't say much about his past. Douglas wrote three autobiographies, and Lincoln at one point referred to or quoted from Gray's Elegy and said that, I can summarize my past by saying it's the common annals of the poor. But both of them essentially learned to rise up by reading, honing their skills in the same six books. One was the Columbian Orator, one was the Bible, Shakespeare was another, Lord Byron, who was with Shakespeare, the two most popular literary writers at the time, Robert Burns's poetry, and Aesop's Fables. Aesop's Fables was a collection, or they were oral tales from the slave Aesop. So, in a sense, Aesop's Fables you can think of as one of the earliest slave narratives.
John Stauffer is my guest. He's chair of the History of American Civilization and professor of English at Harvard. His new book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. How did Douglass finally escape slavery?
He was in Baltimore. He had, to give you a sense of how privileged that he was as a slave, he had been sent to the eastern shore of Maryland. As a slave, he divided his time between the eastern shore of Maryland and Baltimore. He'd been sent to the eastern shore of Maryland, and he tried to run away. after this famous fight with Edward Covey. In fact, another parallel is that both Douglas and Abraham Lincoln characterize a crucial turning point in their young lives as a fight, which is in a sense ironic because it was the same time in which they were both seeing themselves as aspiring to intellectuals. But in any event, Douglas, after this fight with Covey, he wins the fight. He is lucky to remain alive for a variety of reasons. And after the fight, he says, "I will remain I am a free man in form, even if I'm a slave in fact." And from that point forward, he plotted every day to become free. He and some other slaves in the Eastern Shore planned a runaway attempt. It failed. One of the slaves involved in the plot turned traitor, essentially, and exposed it. But instead of being sent south to, say, Mississippi, as most slaves would have been, or even whipped almost to death or to death, Douglas was promised his freedom at age 21 and sent to Baltimore. So he's in Baltimore, and he is able to hire out his time. So it means he doesn't even have to come home every day. He has struck an agreement with his master such that his master wanted him to guarantee certain amount of money each week, which Douglas gave him, and all Douglas had to do was show up once a week, pay Hugh all the money, and the rest of his time was his own. During this period, he met and fell in love with his later wife, Sophia Auld, and so she was absolutely indispensable to him running away. Without her, Douglas would not have been able to escape. She was the one who provided the money for him to buy a sailor's outfit to pass as a free sailor. He escaped by taking a train. She was the one who gave him the money to buy a train ticket. She was the one who gave him the money to purchase the equivalent of a passport to identify himself as a free sailor. So he boards this train on September 3rd, if I remember correctly, on 1838. Douglas would always remember it as the equivalent of his unknown birthday. And the train, it's the train and steamboat, and eventually takes him, lands him in New York City. And he's all alone in New York City. And in fact, the first day there, he says he realizes why some runaways return to slavery, because of the profound loneliness. And New York City at the time was suffering from one of the worst depressions in American history, actually. He eventually gets word to Anna Murray, his fiance. She comes to New York, and within a few days they're married. He is, from that point forward, a fugitive, and eventually achieves his legal freedom after going to England and having his freedom purchased by British sympathizers.
Yeah, because what he did was he wrote that first autobiography explaining what his life had been like.
Yeah. So after he becomes free, Douglas's trajectory is that he goes to New Bedford, Massachusetts, and that city was recommended to him because it was a place where fugitives could be comparatively safe. There are a lot of Quakers there who are relatively sympathetic to fugitives. Also a place where Douglas could apply his skills as a calker. He was a skilled artisan at this time. And from that point, he works as a common laborer and then is essentially discovered by William Lloyd Garrison. And Garrison undersees in Douglas this brilliant orator, hires him on the spot. And from that point forward, Douglas increasingly becomes famous. And he finally writes his first autobiography in 1845. And he literally becomes world famous almost overnight because of that book.
John Stauffer is with us. The new book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. You can join us right after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Good You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. John Stauffer is my guest. He is chair of the History of American Civilization and professor of English at Harvard University. His new book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. If you want to join us, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, John, it's easy to forget this in modern times, but Frederick Douglass was actually a figure of national and even international renown long before Abraham Lincoln was a household word.
Correct. Douglass was considered one of the preeminent, if not the greatest, orator in his day. Douglass was world famous before age 40. In that sense, he resembles Obama in a sense. Whereas Lincoln did not become a national figure until 1860, really, until the presidential election of 1860. After the Civil War, people, particularly William Dean Howells, reassessed Lincoln's legacy by saying that Lincoln had been one of the great orators and of his day. And in fact, Lincoln was a brilliant writer. But Lincoln was not a great orator in the way that Douglass was. Lincoln had a very high-pitched voice. He was at 6'4". He towered over other men. The average height of men was 5'7". And Lincoln had no capacity for using his body language when he spoke. And public speaking is about body performance as much as it is about the words that actually come out of your mouth. And there's a certain music to it. And a lot of people said that Lincoln looked like a nutcracker because he bent his knees in the wrong way, and he, flailed his long arms at the wrong gestures. And whereas Frederick Douglass had this beautiful, deep baritone voice, it could carry. He was immensely poised. Douglass understood also, in a way that Lincoln didn't, that every time he went on stage to speak, he was a performer. He became essentially a work of art, and by becoming an artist, a performer, that was one of the most effective ways to break down racial barriers. And he understood that his world fame was in large part a result of this great artistry. Frederick Douglass could command as high speaking fees as just about any of the white speakers in the country, which is an extraordinary accomplishment. Just one example of how powerful and how convincing Frederick Douglass was as a speaker is that a few years after he was hired by William Lloyd Garrison to become a paid lecturer for the American Anti-Slavery Society, which meant that Douglass traveled around the North trying to convert his audiences to the abolitionist cause, which is a cause advocating an immediate end to slavery and, at least in theory, equality under the law for all men and women in the American Antiquarian Society, American Anti-Slavery Society. And so Douglass, during this 200 convention tour, goes to Buffalo, New York. And Buffalo, New York is a young, bustling, thriving town. And he says nobody's interested in reform. Basically, all the people want to do is make money, and they don't care about abolitionism. And the room or the hall that had been reserved for them was this old post office that was decrepit. In fact, the town was growing so fast, they already moved into a new post office. His first day there, his listeners were five hackmen, essentially the equivalent of cabbies today, and their clothes were filthy, whips in their hand. Douglass went on this tour with another lecturer, a white man, and his co-lecturer was so frustrated and so distraught at Buffalo that he didn't even stay to give a speech. He took the next ferry to Cleveland. So Douglass said he had to do Buffalo alone. So the first speech Buffalo is to five hackmen. Within 10 days, there wasn't a hall big enough for him, and he spoke on the public green in Buffalo to roughly a third of the city's population speaking abolitionist message speaking to the multitude and converting thousands to or hundreds to his cause.
He was that magnetic.
Yeah, he was that magnetic. I mean, the closest equivalent is to think of a charismatic preacher who has the capacity to to transform the thoughts and the minds of the multitude, which is essentially what Douglass was able to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Asher in Dallas. Hi, Asher.
Hi. I had a very interesting time reading Frederick Douglass's autobiography this year, and was wondering kind of two questions. One is how often this is, his autobiography is read, and whether or not it's required reading in high schools or in colleges. And the second question that I had was if we can talk about his run for presidency and for office, and kind of explain. He seems, you know, to be a very progressive individual, and I'm kind of interested in learning more about that. And I can take my answers off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. Thanks. Great questions. Frederick Douglass published three autobiographies, which each one reflected his continual self-making. The one that's most taught is his first one, his 1845 narrative, for a few reasons. One is it's much smaller. It's a little over 100 pages. And I give numerous talks on Frederick Douglass, and the first question I always ask is, how many of you have read anything by Frederick Douglass? And the answer among whites is that it's almost entirely based on age. People under 30, almost everyone has read something by Frederick Douglass, which reflects the fact that Frederick Douglass has entered public education in a way that 25 years ago it never did. People over 50, even if they were alums from Harvard, Yale, the most prestigious institutions, many of them have barely even heard of Frederick Douglass and haven't even read it. So Douglass entering the canon is a phenomenon, really, of the past 25 or so years, which I think is significant. In terms of Douglass's political aspirations, to give you a sense of how audaciously hopeful he was, to paraphrase Obama, when he was still a slave in Baltimore, Maryland, he joined this Mental Improvement Society. It was a league of he was the only slave, free blacks, and it was a debating club, and they debate to try to hone their public speaking skills. And during one debate that Douglass won, or after one debate that he won, he was so excited he said that he would never stop growing until he became a U.S. senator, and this was when he was still a slave. He became the first black man to receive a federal appointment that required Senate approval when he was appointed the Marshal of the District of Columbia. And he was the vice presidential candidate with Victoria Woodhull as presidential candidate on the Equal Rights political party in 1872, a very radical, very small party. And Douglass, in fact, it was such a small party, nothing really ever came of it.
Douglass never wavered in his absolute sense that slavery had to be abolished. But although Lincoln was convinced that slavery was a sin, he struggled with his decision to end it and when to end it. Can you talk about what was at stake for Lincoln and what he had to consider beyond simply this moral issue of bringing people out of bondage?
Yeah. If for Douglass the two central defining aspects of him were, one, his self-making, and two, his identity as an agitator, as a radical activist. For Lincoln, it was his self-making, and second, his identity as a politician and lawyer. And the very fact that Lincoln defined himself throughout his career and was immensely ambitious as a politician and lawyer meant that he could never be a radical. If you have any desire to become president of the United States, there's no way you can be a radical. And that was, Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, said that ambition for Lincoln was a little engine that knew no rest. I mean, I agree with that, although I just add that Mary Todd, who was as passionate about politics as Abraham, she was essentially the fuel for that engine. And so when Lincoln had been a Whig, which believed in a very gradual anti-slavery, most Northerners who believed slavery to be a sin thought that the solution to slavery was very gradual, very congenial emancipation over the generations. So in this sense, they resembled the founding fathers. Most founding fathers, even though they were slave owners, believed slavery to be a sin and hoped that in some future point the nation would progress such that long after they were dead, slavery would end. And the reason for that gradualism is to prevent an uprooting of the social order. Lincoln was part of that. And with gradual emancipation, or the idea of gradual emancipation, came the idea of colonization, that as we emancipate the slaves, we colonize them in a different country, specifically Africa or Haiti, because most gradual emancipationists imagined the United States essentially as a white nation for a variety of reasons. Lincoln, as a politician, whether in the Illinois State Senate, and Illinois was settled mostly by Southerners, or running for the House of Representatives when he became a one-term congressman, or Senate after 1854, the presidential, had he come out as even a conservative abolitionist, there's no way he could have been elected. The Republican Party's it had a central platform for the non-extension of slavery, prohibiting the spread of slavery, with the aim, as Lincoln said, for its ultimate extinction. But Lincoln specifically said during his debates with Stephen Douglas that, "I don't believe ultimate extinction can come in less than 100 years. That would have put it at 1958, which is when he said that. So his vision for an end to slavery was very consistent with other Whig anti-slavery advocates and Republican anti-slavery advocates, and also coupled with that was the advocacy for colonization. It was really the war that changed his attitudes, and Lincoln was very forthright in saying that his chief goal in the war was to preserve the Union. He ultimately ended slavery because he realized that he needed blacks on the Union side to help him defeat the Confederacy. As Frederick Douglass said from the outbreak of the war, that blacks are the stomach of the rebellion. If you emancipate the slaves and you make black men soldiers, it will transform the military fight, and it will swiftly end the war. Lincoln waited to do that for a variety of reasons, and in fact, when for the first year and a half of the war, Frederick Douglass considered Lincoln one of the greatest obstacle to ending the war, because Douglass firmly believed that the swiftest way to end the war is to emancipate the slaves, bring 4 million blacks to the Union cause. You deny them the ability to grow food for the Confederacy, to do the Confederacy's dirty work, build fortifications, etc., which the Confederacy had used them for, and the war would end very quickly.
Yeah, in 1862, Lincoln gives this speech to a delegation of African Americans, and depending on how you look at it, it was either sort of pragmatic or quite paternalistic.
Right.
But he tells them, look, even once you're freed in this country, you're never going to have an equal footing. And so my suggestion is you go off and move to South America where you've got a better shot.
Right.
And Douglass gets wind of this and is incensed.
He is incensed. He calls Lincoln a representative American racist, essentially, after that. In that meeting where Lincoln invited this coalition of Washington, D.C., it was mostly freedmen, so they really weren't very literate. Some were illiterate. It's been interpreted a number of ways. One way is that Lincoln had already drafted an Emancipation Proclamation, so he wanted to make this speech very public in order to conciliate Northerners and prevent them from being outraged over the specter of all these of free men and women coming to their communities.
So he was laying the groundwork, essentially.
He was essentially laying the groundwork, but for Frederick Douglass's perspective, because he understood from the beginning that the swiftest way to end the war is to free the blacks and arm them, it was another indication of Lincoln's prejudice, his racial prejudice, and so he was absolutely outraged. And so one of the really rich journeys that these two men had is at the beginning of the war, from the beginning of the war through that moment in July of 1862, really until the Lincoln announced his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in on September 22nd of 1862, Douglas hated Lincoln. And the closest Frederick Douglass ever came to giving up hope in the United States as a nation that could ever fulfill its national ideas was right after Lincoln's inaugural address. Because in the inaugural address, Lincoln fervently defends the fugitive slave law, which virtually legitimates the kidnapping of free blacks in the North. And more importantly, Lincoln embraces the first 13th Amendment. A few days before Lincoln's first inaugural in 1861, Congress, in an attempt to conciliate with the southern states, seven of which had already seceded, the Confederacy had already been formed, Congress had passed the first 13th Amendment, which was an unamendable amendment guaranteeing slavery in the states forever. And Lincoln says, I have no problem with this amendment. And for Douglas, it was a sign that Lincoln had completely overturned his entire platform in running for presidency, because his basic central platform was prohibiting the spread of slavery with the goal toward its ultimate extinction. And yet here's this same person saying, embracing this 13th Amendment, which is an unamendable amendment guaranteeing slavery forever, throws out the window the idea of ultimate extinction. And so Douglas made plans to move to Haiti. With the hopes of visiting it, with hopes of settling there and encouraging other blacks to go there. The only reason he decided to stay was the war broke out and he realized it was an opportunity to end slavery throughout the United States.
Talk more about how that progressed after this break. John Stauffer is here. His new book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or get on the phones 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Stauffer. His new book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So after the Battle of Antietam, Lincoln finally announces publicly that he has this plan for January 1st of 1863 for abolition to begin and for emancipation to happen. How did that change the course of the war?
It profoundly changes the course of the war. And first of all, I should say, which I think too many historians downplay, is that Lincoln had drafted an Emancipation Proclamation before Antietam, as early as I think June or July, and he, on the advice of William Seward, waited to make it public until the Union achieved a victory. And to give you a sense of Lincoln's religiosity, he knew that Lee would engage McClellan because Lee was moving north, and he was pushing McClellan to engage Lee, and it became the Battle of Antietam. And before the battle began, Lincoln entered into a covenant with God. Told his cabinet about his covenant with God, and the covenant with God was that, God, if you give Union forces a victory, then I will fulfill my end make public this Emancipation Proclamation. McClellan declares a tenuous victory, and within a day or two, Lincoln makes public the Emancipation Proclamation and follows through with it. It transforms the war in a number of ways. One, it brings African Americans to the side of the Union as never before. Frederick Douglass said that the Emancipation Proclamation should be treated alongside of the Declaration of Independence as the twin births of liberty, was his term. Even though Douglass knew that the Emancipation Proclamation did not free a single slave in the border states, because Lincoln didn't think that was constitutional, and Douglass also knew that the total number of slaves technically freed by the Emancipation Proclamation was, you know, about 500,000 or so. But he said Douglass's point was that with slavery outlawed in Mississippi, there's no way it can endure in Maryland or Kentucky or in Delaware. And so with the Emancipation Proclamation, Northern blacks were volunteered. There was a massive recruitment effort for black soldiers in the North. And in fact, Douglass devoted all of his energies, beginning with the Emancipation Proclamation, which really opened the way, opened the floodgates for recruiting black soldiers. He devoted every waking hour to recruiting black soldiers. In fact, he almost single-handedly recruited blacks to the famous 54th Regiment. His two sons were among his first two recruits. And the use of black soldiers in the Union Army was partly a function of Union generals telling Lincoln, we need black soldiers, we need people. That the North knew that with they had a benefit of far more people, that all the South needed to do was to defend itself. The North had to overpower them. So over the course of 1863 was a transformative year. 1863, you had a Grant taking Vicksburg and cutting the Confederacy in two. It was, I would say, Vicksburg was Vicksburg was more important than Gettysburg, and that was a function of Grant's savvy use of blacks in his campaign. And meanwhile, Lee is defeated at Gettysburg. Those were two crucial turning points in the war. I mean, there was a period in 1864, though, in the summer of 1864, which was the second time Douglass met Lincoln in the White House, because Lincoln called him for an urgent visit, in which most Northerners were simply tired of war. The Copperhead Democrats, or people who were virulently racist, were outraged at the idea of black soldiers or blacks taking up arms to shoot whites. That outraged them. So they didn't like that idea, and most Northerners were ready for peace. And Lincoln felt sure that the Democrat would win the 1864 election. McClellan was the Democratic candidate, and if the Democrats won, their basic platform was immediate peace, negotiated settlement, slavery would remain intact. Essentially, a Democratic victory in 1864 would have meant victory for the Confederacy. And so Lincoln calls Frederick Douglass to the White House for an urgent meeting, telling him that he needs his help. So Douglass goes there, and Lincoln says, I think I'm going to lose election. What I want you to do is embark on a John Brown scheme. John Brown had famously raided the Federal Arsenal at Harper's Ferry in an attempt to incite the massive slave rebellion. And Lincoln wanted Douglass to essentially invade the South and bring back as many blacks, as many slaves as possible into Union lines. At the very best, this increased manpower can turn the tide of war and bring about a swift victory. At the very worst, Democrats win, but more blacks will be freed and in Union lines. And Douglass said after this meeting he never realized how much Lincoln hated slavery. And Douglass had been a close friend of John Brown. Douglass was a militant. He was not opposed to taking up arms against the United States if he felt it could help end slavery. And within 2 weeks or so, a few weeks of that meeting, Sherman was victorious at Atlanta and started marching to the sea, and that essentially clinched the war, and there was no need for this John Brown-style raid into the South. And following Sherman's victory in Atlanta, March to the Sea, it was everyone in the North knew that the end of the war was very near, and Lincoln won the re-election in a landslide.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Jeff in Tyler. Hello, Jeff.
Oh, hi. It's good to hear you, Chris. I have just been halfway through a book called Capital Men. I wanted to comment on it. It was about Reconstruction, Blacks in the Senate and House. By Philip Dre. It's interesting. I took up this book during during this election because they were such outstanding men.
They were.
The matchup with Douglas. In fact, one of them replaced Jefferson Davis in the Senate, and racist senators from Indiana and others commented that they had lost no intelligence by the loss of Jefferson Davis.
Right. I think that the Reconstruction, the blacks' capacity to become very literate, very quick. Most of them were former slaves, and what they accomplished in the Senate, the two black senators, numerous black congressmen. It was a huge success. I mean, most people think of Reconstruction as a dismal failure, but when you look at how African Americans were able to act on this newfound constitutional mandates for equality under the law, it was a huge success. And in that sense, I would argue that ultimately the South wins the war. After Appomattox, Southerners go home and they continue shooting at blacks and Republicans, and they ultimately win a war of attrition. It goes from being a military war to a paramilitary war. And African Americans who served in Congress and who served in their local legislatures and who acted on the newfound constitutional changes of citizenship and freedom and suffrage it was extraordinary, but they ultimately it ultimately got overturned and defeated by a by Southerners who were determined to do whatever they could to restore the old order.
At the end of what would be Lincoln's life, when he would visit with Frederick Douglass, he treated him with a great deal of warmth and affection in addition to respect. Can you talk about what, you know, they didn't have much time where they sort of personally knew each other.
Right.
But can you talk about how the relationship evolved during that time?
Yeah, their first meeting, Douglass came to the White House. He didn't have a meeting. There was no meeting plan, but he came to the White House because he had certain agendas that he wanted to air with Lincoln. Black soldiers, it was August of 63, black soldiers were getting half the pay of whites. They weren't getting promoted, and Lincoln and the Union had not passed a retaliatory order against the Confederacy. Confederates treated black soldiers as slave insurrectionaries, and so if they were captured, they were executed rather than being taken prisoner. And Douglass and others wanted a retaliatory order saying for every Union soldier executed by Confederates, we will execute a Confederate soldier. And so at their first meeting, first of all, Lincoln gets in line. There's already a long line to meet the presidents early in the morning. Lincoln was known for having an open-door policy. This is August 10th of 1863. Douglass sends up his card. He figures he's going to have to wait all day, maybe 2 days. Within 2 minutes, he's called up because Lincoln knows who he is. And the first thing Lincoln says when he sees Frederick Douglass is, "I know you. It's good to meet you." Essentially, thanks for coming. And so Douglass makes his claim. They get along very well, even though it was a relatively short meeting. At that meeting, Lincoln gives Frederick Douglass an open invitation, saying, "Whenever you're in Washington, please come see me." Part of their interpersonal warmth stemmed from the fact that they both had enormous respect for each other as self-made men. After that first meeting, Lincoln told a friend that he considered Frederick Douglass one of the most meritorious, if not the most meritorious, men in the United States. And Douglass knew that Lincoln was one of the great self-made men. So there was a kind of kindred spirit in their own self-making. And that self-making, that continual self-making, ultimately, I argued, was antithetical to the idea of racism, because the racism depends upon the self as fixed. It depends upon this fixed notion of whiteness or white skin as superior to darker skin. And Douglass and Lincoln both embraced this idea of a self in a state of continual flux. And after that first meeting, Douglas, even though he understood that politically Lincoln was far apart from him, said, "Lincoln was one of the few white men who treated me as a man rather than as a black man." And then in their second meeting, it was a two-hour meeting. This is when Lincoln calls Douglas to come to the White House. And in fact, there were other dignitaries and legislators waiting to see Lincoln, and he makes them wait and spends time talking to Douglas for, according to Douglas, roughly 2 hours. And Lincoln then, soon after that, invited Douglas to his soldier's home, the retreat he went to in the summer to escape the heat. And Douglas couldn't go only because he had already made plans to give a speech. And then their third meeting was at the inaugural. Douglas attended the second inaugural along with numerous other blacks. Roughly, according to one newspaper report, the second inaugural the crowd there was almost half black, and Douglas had essentially the equivalent of like a front row seat. He was right in front of Lincoln. He went to the reception at the White House after the speech. Lincoln was turned away at the door. The guard says no black man is allowed. Douglas says not true, and sends word to Lincoln, who lets him in. And when Lincoln sees Douglas, he says, "It's good to see you. I saw you in the crowd today. What did you think of my speech? I consider there are few men, or there's no man whose opinion I value more than yours." He refers to Douglas as a friend, and Douglas says, "Mr. Lincoln, that was a sacred effort." He considered it. Douglas virtually memorized the second inaugural and quoted it frequently for the rest of his life. So it's a wonderful kind of convergence at the end, particularly given how in the immediate wake of the first inaugural, Douglas is ready to leave the United States for Haiti because of Lincoln. And 4 years later, they have acknowledged a friendship, primarily utilitarian, but they genuinely liked each other. Utilitarian because ultimately Frederick Douglass understood that he needed Lincoln on his side to help him achieve his goal of ending slavery. And Lincoln ultimately understood that he needed Douglas on his side. Douglas is a kind of ambassador of African Americans, the voice piece of blacks, to help him win the war. Because Lincoln finally realized that without the aid of blacks, the Union could not win.
John Stauffer is chair of the History of American Civilization and professor of English at Harvard University. His new book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. John, really interesting story. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thanks so much, Chris. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.